From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum program, former Facebook product manager Antonio Garcia Martinez begins his memoir with the following dedication. To all my enemies, I could not have done it without you. A tech insider, Martinez sold a startup to Twitter and was then hired and later fired by Facebook. His new book, Chaos Monkeys, shatters some of the myths of startup culture and provides a window into the day-to-day workings of Silicon Valley, including the backstabbing and double-dealing that he willingly participated in. Forum begins after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. Antonio Garcia Martinez joins us in studio for this forum hour, a graduate physics student at University of California, Berkeley. He left a PhD program there and went to work on Wall Street for Goldman Sachs and then came west to the Bay Area, selling his advertising startup AdGrok to Twitter and later working for and getting fired from Facebook. He's written an insider bridge-burning book about Silicon Valley in which he says, and this is on the back of the book, the reality is Silicon Valley capitalism is very simple. Investors are people with more money than time. Employees are people with more time than money. Entrepreneurs are simply the seductive go-between. Startups are business experiments performed with other people's money. Marketing is like sex. Only losers pay for it. The book is titled Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley, and we welcome Antonio Garcia Martinez to this forum. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, where to begin? Let's begin with the title. I mean, you can see monkeys perhaps as coming out of this industry, but you're talking really about software programs to test resilience.
Right. So the Chaos Monkey is actually a piece of software that was created by Netflix. And the image to have is a wild monkey sort of flailing through a data center, kicking a box, pulling on cables, and basically killing servers. And the point of the software is to test the robustness to failure in a service like streaming House of Cards, for example. I use the title really metaphorically to mean startups these days are like the chaos monkeys to society. And what they do is they go and they pull the plug on taxis with an app like Uber and say, anybody can become a taxi driver now. Or they go and they pull a plug on hotels and say, hey, we've got Airbnb. And so this is Silicon Valley is the zoo where the chaos monkeys are kept. And what they do is basically test, you know, our robustness to their innovation, basically.
And you carry that metaphor into there being plenty of bananas in the
zoo. Oh, absolutely. There's no shortage of bananas now. That's right.
Let me talk about, sort of frame this in a sense of, because you start out in your memoir really talking about Goldman Sachs and Wall Street. And there are a lot of both implicit and explicit comparisons of Wall Street to Silicon Valley, and almost the sense one gets from reading your book that there's a trajectory, not only in your own life, but maybe in our economy, moving from what was Wall Street as a paradigm to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think the reality is Silicon Valley is now where, you know, the ambitious East Coast elite is their first stop. They don't go to consulting and investment banking like perhaps I did maybe and then burned out and come to Silicon Valley. I mean, Silicon Valley is basically their first stop. And there's all sorts of other parallels you can draw between, I think, companies like Goldman and Facebook in terms of how they do business and how incumbents basically maintain their sort of informational advantage in their market and how they try to keep it sort of non-transparent rather than transparent in general.
Well, you were in credit derivatives, and even when you go back in memory to Wall Street, you take us through a kind of score settling. I mean, the book is a kind of score settler. I'll talk about the dedication in a moment, which is to your enemies, but even I remember seeing the great Elie Wiesel just departed from us. There's a little thing about his son, who was kind of your boss on Wall Street, who turns out to be, from your perspective, a real SOB. I mean, how much of this book is like letting the chips fall where they may in terms of getting back at people?
You know, that really wasn't my intent. I know it's described that way and it might seem that way. I mean, the reality is, as you know, you noted earlier that that same unsparing eye that I train on others around me, I train on myself and my own actions. I don't hold myself at a remove from the sort of, you know, harsh moral criticism that I have in the book.
I gave you props for that before we went on.
Yeah,
the air,
right, sorry. So yeah, know, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I don't think it's score settling. I think I just, with absolutely no filter, I describe the world around me as it was presented to me.
Well, that world around you is described as wholly devoid of morality and a reactionary crowd and other things that, you know, may not sit well with people in Silicon Valley, especially in a general way.
In my opinion, the writer's task is to hold up a mirror to society. If society doesn't like the image that it sees in that mirror, it's not the fault of the craftsman who built the mirror.
It's a tech whorehouse where morality is, just taking your words and throwing them back at you, an expensive hobby.
That's one way to put it.
That's the way you put it.
Yeah.
In fact, in some ways, you use an analogy to the mafia, at least among the higher-ups, the upper echelon and the titans of Silicon Valley.
And I should mention that's a compliment. The context in which I mentioned that term, and it's funny, it's the second time an interview mentions it, is in the context of the accelerator who funded us, a company called Y Combinator that's very well-known in the Valley. And they're very loyal to their sort of child companies. And we got into serious legal troubles, and they really went to bat for us. And In a world of very fickle relationships where loyalty, frankly, trades at a premium, it was refreshing to see that they would stand up for a company that at the time really meant nothing to them.
That was a stand-up thing. Of course, you're often talking, though, about particularly in the startup culture, which you write about a good deal, about how things get shifted around and people essentially have to look like they're doing well when they're not necessarily doing well. That's the game, really, isn't it?
Right, right. Everyone's always killing it. Everyone's always crushing it. Every plot is always up and to the right. Everything is just this sort of go-go, rah-rah boosterism. And the reality is that every startup has like four or five, you know, horribly existentially wrong things with them. And everyone knows this, but no one really admits it. And so, there's this sort of everyone has a very well manicured exterior, and Chaos Monkeys attempts to sort of remove that.
So let's talk about your dedication as to your enemies.
The reality is that there's only really two sort of maybe even just one bad guy in the book. I think in the first half of the book, which is sort of the startup side of it, we got sued by my previous employer. I would maintain maliciously, and yeah, he was one of the enemies that forced us in a certain direction, and counterintuitively, it actually brought us together as a company. I think surviving this lawsuit actually. I wouldn't be here without my enemies.
That may be true for most of us. You're also. Your regard is in some ways higher for Facebook, even though you're somewhat critical. You talk about it as a culture of fascism, for example.
Right.
But it seems like there's respect in you. Let's sort of take your attitude towards Zuckerberg. I mean, on the one hand, you compare him to visionaries like Thomas Jefferson, and yet you also compare him to Jim Jones in terms of getting people to drink the Kool-Aid.
Right. That's right. I mean, it's funny, the reaction, I'm sure at some point you're going to ask me what's been the reaction from some of my former colleagues, right? Because they sort of expected a very negative hit piece. And the reality is, I think on the net of it, I'm actually kind of pro-Facebook because I absolutely did admire their culture. And I absolutely drank the Kool-Aid when I was first there. I can't claim, it might seem as if I'm at some sort of sardonic remove, but I was as much a sort of, loyal foot soldier to Zuckerberg as anybody else at the time.
It's fascinating, though, the way you take us into the hierarchical world of Facebook and actually lay it out for us where the different offices are and how Zuckerberg operates in that. You talk about it as being particularly when Google Plus came out as being a little bit like the Soviet Union. There was a lockdown and there were posters and things. But you make the analogy to Samizdat and all that sort of thing.
Right.
I mean, it had that kind of closed hermetic seal to it.
Yeah, I mean, all this communist thing. There's one scene in which it's February 1st, 2012, the day that the IPO is announced, right? And Zuck is telling everyone to sort of stay focused on the mission and not think about money. And it just struck me. I make a comparison there to communist Cuba. My parents are Cuban political exiles, and it there's a parallel there. We're all wearing the same clothing. We're all sitting in line in rank and file, listening to our visionary leader sort of harangue us with a set of values. And then of course there's the inner members of the party, one of whom was shopping for expensive real estate, right? And so we're all focused, but some of us were more focused than others to get a little Orwellian about it, right? And then you mix that with all the posters on the wall, and I just thought, my God, at their extremes, communism and capitalism meet, effectively, and you have the same sort of theatrics and aesthetics, just the end result is, somewhat different.
Yeah, you actually describe the Facebook society, as it were, its culture as being two-tiered. I mean, there are those who are extremely rich and those who are rich, but they're middle class by comparison.
Right. I mean, one of the misconceptions that I try to fix about Silicon Valley is that everyone thinks, like I tell them, I joined Facebook before the IPO. Oh, you're a wealthy guy. That's actually not true. And it wasn't true for most people who joined when I joined. The reality is, and you had this at Google as well, was that the very early employees, they were worth serious money. We're talking tens or hundreds of millions. And then everyone else was what one would call sort of Silicon Valley middle class, which I was, right? And, it's one of those points of social friction that it never really got spoken about and was hinted at, but no one could actually put their finger on it or really speak about it openly. Because the reality was often you had a peer, someone who was no better at their job than you were, in fact, possibly worse, And who was worth 100 times what you were worth, right? And I actually quote the famous Google masseuse who said, you know, on Monday at Google, one person would come in from on a private flight from Belize and the other went to the movies. What sort of conversation are they going to have on Monday morning, right? And that's the same challenge that Facebook faced.
Do you see this as one of the downsides of the Facebook culture? I mean, because the company actually had record profits in 2015, for example, and a lot of people who work there seem very happy to work there.
They absolutely do. I think it's just one of those things that if you were one of the later employees, you just suck up that fact. We're getting very Marxist in this conversation. But one of the other things that I point that I thought was interesting, that the middle management class, the sort of middle tier, who, again, are not necessarily worth a lot of money, you know, side with the sort of corporate values against the sort of everyday workers that they work with in some ways. Marx would say that the management class has had the property owning class's values instilled in it and takes side against sort of the proletariat, so to speak. To get a little bit off the peak,
your parents are Cuban exiles, and you're talking
Marx. I know. This is heretical. I'll be banished from Miami and Silicon Valley. But yeah.
Now, the belief in the cause in a kind of all-consuming way is how you describe Facebook culture.
I call it corporate fascism, to be honest, to switch to the other side of the spectrum. And it's intoxicating. We're living in sort of a postmodern haze with a lack of values. We don't have tribe. We don't have religion. You know, patriotism is somewhat déclassé, et cetera. And so what do we have left, right? People embrace their company as tribe. I mean, if I were still working at Facebook, I'd be wearing a Facebook fleece right now with a little logo, and that would define me. That's who I am. That's the tribe that I'm part of.
But you say you drank the Kool-Aid too, and yet you also write in your book that every day at Facebook felt like a year.
The slogan was every day feels like a week. And then I think I said every week feels like a month. I mean, it was working at Facebook was thrilling in many ways, in that it was all consuming and it was kind of exhausting at the same time.
Let's talk. And by the way, I want to remind listeners, the book that we're talking about is titled Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. And we're talking with tech community insider Antonio Garcia Martinez about his new memoir, which is all about Silicon Valley startup culture. There was a book that came out about Hollywood, which was a tell-all that said, I'll never eat lunch in this town again. That's not necessarily the case for you in Silicon Valley. I presume you still have friends there and people there who appreciated your book and your candor. But you were almost in some ways, I suppose you could characterize you as trying to be honest to a fault. And there's been some blowback, and let's talk about that. Let's talk about your own statement about it was your kid's first birthday, your daughter's first birthday, and there's all your, shall we say, relationships and liaisons that you write about in this book also. But you didn't go to a birthday party, and the reason you didn't go to a birthday party was this kind of ethic that success forgives all sins. That is an ethos of Silicon Valley?
Oh, I absolutely think so. And I cite the early example of luminaries that we now revere as heroes like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and the slightly underhanded things they did early on to get started. I think it was that definitely is the ethos. Yeah.
And then when you write about women, and you've been gotten some, I think, pushback on this, Bay Area women are soft and weak with self-regarding entitlement feminism. Can you flesh that out for us a little
more? Yeah, my God, that paragraph is going to go on my tombstone. Every reviewer has mentioned it. What I was trying to say there, and it's funny because I can picture my editor nodding her head saying, I told you we should have removed that paragraph, which she tried to remove. I actually put my foot down. What I was trying to say there, I was trying to contrast a certain type of woman that I'd experienced in obviously a very anecdotal way to the mother of my children, who was very much not that, actually. She was very much very strong-willed, very independent, very much her own woman. And so I was drawing that contrast. And it's part of the reason why I found her so attractive at the time is precisely because she had that steely will that we'd see later.
But, you know, Silicon Valley has this label, of, whether it's justified or not, as being misogynistic and sexist, kind of a frat boy culture and all that sort of thing. You even at one point describe an Asian coworker as your prize. I guess you've probably – I'm sorry, you're covering your eyes. I don't mean to shame you, but it's there in the book. That's part of the culture, isn't it?
I think it's fair to say. I think there's definitely a bit of a frat boy culture in Silicon Valley. I mention a thing called the programmer meme, and the notion there is – you know, I think we have this image of the technologist as this sort of geeky guy in a basement with like a monitor tan and not the reality now that is in fact that many people that you'd assume or associate with like the frat boy culture or the captain of a football team are actually going into technology and they dress well and they work out and they have a sort of full and rich life and yet they're geeks, right? And that's sort of the programmer culture. But along with that comes some of the baggage of that very traditional all male culture. And yeah, you do see some of that in Silicon Valley.
You also, I think, make a case in the book, a very important case, about what's done in Silicon Valley to privacy and what people, I think, particularly this listening audience, ought to be aware of. Because it seems like me, you're sending out flares. You're sending out caveats.
Yeah. I mean, I address privacy a lot. I mean, just to be clear, my first job at Facebook was as the product manager for the ads targeting team. So my job was turning your data into money. Basically, that was my job. And so, yeah, I have a lot to say about privacy. I mean, the short version of it, if you want me to go into it, is, you know, people kind of worry about the wrong things when they use Facebook, right? I mean, they think Facebook cares about the messages to their partner or photos of a birthday party. And the reality is, and this is a slightly salty metaphor, but, you know, you might be worried that there's a nude photo of you on the internet. That doesn't mean anyone would actually pay money to see it, right? And that's the attitude to have about your personal data. I mean, the reality is that a lot of your personal data, no offense, has no commercial value from an advertising point of view. And actually what Facebook cares about is a lot of things that you don't even realize you're sharing with Facebook. For example, Facebook knows who you are on every device that you use. So your home machine, your work machine, your tablet, your iPhone. Facebook can actually join all those experiences together into one unique vision of you. And that's actually extremely valuable. And people actually should probably think about that more than their photos.
Also, maybe want to make people think about H-1B visas, which you go, you say they're like masters of old buying servants off the ship, or strictly speaking, H-1B visas are non-immigrant and temporary. And so this hazing ritual of immigrant initiation, which is done and which you codify here, is unlawful. Yet everyone's on the take, including the government, which charges thousands in filing fees. The entire system is rigged. Sounds a little like Trump, but, you know, you're talking about a system that is corrupt.
Yeah, I mean, I liken it to indentured servitude, which for your listeners, that this was a form of basically semi-slavery in the past in which, you know, the poor people of Europe would effectively sell years of their labor to afford the passage to the United States, right? And they were bonded. They had to work whatever it was, 5-10 years in that company. And that effectively is what the H-1B visa is. You have to work for a certain company for 3 to 6 years before you even get any sort of permanent status. And as we learned, and this came up in the context of my co-founder, who was not a U.S. national, leaving the previous company before AgRock, and he was threatened to be reported to the immigration authorities. And why is that? Because the moment he left that company, he literally had to get on a plane and go. He just could not stay. He was an illegal. And that's how the H-1B visa works. And frankly, a lot of companies exploit that to get relatively underpriced labor and, you know, slave away in the galleys of their companies.
You want people to come away with this kind of education from your book? I mean, is it as important to you? Because there was, in fact, a New York Times review of your book, and they said, I don't know if this is more valuable for people who want to get into Silicon Valley and find out how to do a startup or join Facebook as opposed to learning a great number of things that are there for the taking.
Right. I think in that same – he was very perceptive, that reviewer. At the end, he said it's similar to Liar's Poker, which his book is being compared to, right? Because it's that same sort of gonzo insider take. You know, I write a sort of cautionary tale, but the reality is that for many, it might actually end up being a siren song. And I suspect many will read this and say, this is great, and get on a flight to San Francisco, which, you know, wasn't quite my intent, but there it is.
What was your intent? That's really what I'm getting at here.
You know, it'll sound grandiose, you know, my mother was a librarian. I was raised in a library. To me, books and history matter. And I think we're living through exceptional times, right? I mean, if you think about it, all of the world's knowledge now exists in a small, slim device in our pockets, right? Our social lives, what makes us us, is now intermediated by companies like Facebook and lives in our pocket, right? 2 centuries from now, people will ask questions like, what was it like when that happened, right? I mean, to me, what we're going through now is comparable to the Industrial Revolution, to Gutenberg's printing press, et cetera, right? And I wanted to tell that story and answer that question because, frankly, nobody else was.
And do you, when you talk about this reactionary crowd that Facebook is, I mean, there's a sense of living in the Bay Area and being maybe more progressive and everything, but you're really labeling them as being politically on the right. Is that the libertarianism that runs endemic through Silicon Valley?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Some other commenter made the observation that what we might think of traditionally Silicon Valley company being culture being sort of empowered hippies, a sort of counterculture, Steve Jobs, right, sort of going against the man and creating, you know, his 1984 ad, for example, for famously from Apple. And I think it's changed in a big way. It's become it's gone from being the flower children with computers to being the sort of steely-eyed libertarians who don't want anyone to stand in their way, whether it be government or other companies. And yeah, I think the tone and the culture have very much changed.
And what about, you know, you write about, for example, racing sports cars on 101. I mean, that side of the culture, or, you know, drinking and negotiating with a police officer is kind of a fascinating anecdote, learning how you can, perhaps even when you're technically a little bit certain sheets to the wind, or however you want to describe it, having done a U-turn and everything, maybe get your way out of that. A lot of this sort of reflects Silicon Valley, or you, or both?
No, I mean, I think it reflects a certain class of startup entrepreneur who is very risk-taking and is a bit of a thrill freak. I mean, they seek risk in this very sort of uncontrolled way. I think there are all aspects. I mean, what I'm really getting at, and I use the term more than once, is that Silicon Valley, it'll sound strong, but is basically populated by sociopaths, right? It's people who have a certain glib charm, and again, I'm not necessarily excluding myself from that description, but who have a certain glib persuasive charm, but are completely manipulative and only out for themselves and engage in very risk-taking behavior like racing cars or promiscuity, right? I mean, that is the textbook DSM-4 definition of sociopathy, and it describes an entire class of people that I knew and interacted with on Silicon Valley.
Entire class of people who are mainly the ones who do succeed driven towards success ambitious.
Yeah, I mean the actual risk takers, the founders of the companies, not the VCs, not the late stage employees, not the journalists, just that one class of person, you know, the one guy or the one woman occasionally who, you know, raises money and starts a company and tries to race their borrowed car. I was racing a borrowed car. Like if I had smashed the car, it wasn't even mine, right? That's symbolic of the very companies themselves, right?
It's what Fitzgerald describes as the carelessness of the rich to a great degree.
I wasn't rich.
They smash things up and then they let other people pick up the pieces. And you're living now on a 40-foot sailboat in the San Francisco Bay?
Indeed. That always comes up. It's not as romantic as it sounds, but indeed, I do live on a boat, yes.
And you prefer to live there to those houses that some of those people who became rich in Silicon Valley were looking and pricing when they realized they had IPO'd?
Yeah. I mean, the reason I lived on a boat when I was at Facebook as well, and I think it was a coping mechanism with the realization that I was becoming kind of a yuppie, sort of bougie, sort of techie guy. And my one act of juvenile rebellion was saying, no, I'm not going to, you know, live in some townhouse in Mountain View. I'm going to live on a boat instead. And there we are.
There you are.
Childish.
And here he is, our guest, Antonio Garcia Martinez. If you have questions for him or if you have comments, this always seems to stir up a lot of controversy when people come on and express strong opinions about Silicon Valley and its culture. And some of you are probably watching the Silicon Valley TV series, which I haven't broached yet or haven't immersed myself in, but we'll try to when I find the time, because I hear it's pretty good. Have you seen it, by the way, Antonio?
I've seen a few scenes. I don't actually have a TV, but I have watched a few scenes online. And I think it's very accurate, actually. And all my friends love it.
And your friends probably find your book accurate, too. Let's find out what our listeners have to say. And by the way, we did ask on our Facebook page, we asked a question about your response to Silicon Valley in general. We asked, and particularly for tech workers, what are the question for listeners? What do we get right or wrong about the life in high tech and the world of Silicon Valley? Or what do people like Antonio get right or wrong? You can join us, and we invite you to do that. Please feel free to call us now. The toll-free number, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or email forum@kqed.org. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Antonio Garcia Martinez about his new book, which is all about his years in the thick of Silicon Valley's greed and double dealing. And please give us a call if you have something you'd like to, well, join us with in conversation. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. And our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Let me just read some comments that are coming in here. This is Chris, who says, I heard this line from the TV show Silicon Valley, which I mentioned before we went to the break. I don't want to live in a world where someone else is making the world a better place better than we are. Brilliant. Let us be clear. None of this is about making the world a better place. But that gets into the drinking of the Kool-Aid a bit, Antonio. I mean, there are people in Silicon Valley who I've talked to about this, and not only do they feel they are making the world a better place by connecting everybody, for example, Facebook people, but they take great umbrage when you criticize that.
Yeah, I would maybe disagree with the commenter. I mean, as I get into one of my chapters, the sort of scarier reality actually is that at Facebook, people actually believed, you know, the statement, we're creating a more open and connected world, which is basically Facebook's mantra. People actually believe that. I mean, that's why very wealthy people stay working the long hours they do there, because they believe in the mission, right? And they won't stop until everyone from, you know, an African herder to an Indian farmer to an American millennial is checking in on Instagram or Facebook.
You're characterizing them as we used to call true believers, Eric Fromm's.
They absolutely are true believers, yeah. Which if you think about it is scarier in a way because they do believe.
Well, here's another listener says, totally agree with Antonio Garcia. Double dealing and greed have taken over Silicon Valley. It all shows in the disastrous effect on the Bay Area's obscenely high housing cost, unemployment, and homelessness. And let me give you props for something else. I mean, you do this with a little bit, I think, of tongue-in-cheek, but you're also serious about it. You talk about some guy on a way to a yoga lesson. I mean, this is sort of obviously cooked up in your imagination probably, but it could happen, stepping over a homeless guy, you know, trying to hurry to his yoga class. I mean, and I found myself thinking, well, it's a good metaphor for saying, you know, there's this neglect and unawareness or obtuseness about people who are living under highways and all that sort of thing or on the streets. What would you have them do? What would you think they should do?
That's a complex question. I mean, I think one thing I would note is that in general, people didn't seem to have a sense of civic mindedness and belonging that they do in other cities. I mean, the reality is everyone in this tech world, almost nobody is from San Francisco, right? And while they live here, I don't think they feel a sense of responsibility towards a city that perhaps you do in a city like Boston or New York.
People want connection but don't feel connection with the city that they are in?
Exactly. They're basically indifferent, yeah.
A few more comments, then we'll go to your calls. So listener comments, not to defend high tech too strongly, but I'd wager that much of what he saw were characteristics of any booming but high-risk sector and any boomtown back to Babylon.
That's right. I mean, this is the modern-day version of wildcatting for oil in Texas in the 60s or potentially, you know, cargo ships in northern Italy.
The
gold rush is the obvious analogy. Yeah.
And Jeffrey says, you use the term Silicon Valley middle class as opposed to those who have tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. How do you define Silicon Valley middle class?
It's being able to afford for yourself what would be considered middle class in any other part of the world, which means a $1 million house, a $30,000 a year daycare or school. It means, you know, an $80,000 Tesla car. You know, it means all these things that whose price tags are 4 or 5x what they would normally be.
And we'll bring on our callers. And let me go first to Arjade. Arjade, do I have your name right?
Yes, sir. Arkady.
Arkady. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes, Mr. Garcia, I was wondering if you believe that the fact that the money is initially given to startups rather than earned makes them spend that money, maybe not in a way that they would spend it if they had to work for it initially, and whether that could be compared to some kind of a dependent child that instead of using money wisely is spending it on maybe some frivolous things or things that they otherwise wouldn't be spending, and whether that's a major factor in the fact that so many startups fail.
Yeah, that's probably a good point. I mean, the reality of venture capital, the reason why it's venture capital is a lot of these businesses don't have clear monetization models. Of course, that doesn't mean that they're not worth something down the line or they're not worth something as part of something bigger, right, which is what drives a lot of acquisitions. But you're right that they often do frivolously spend their money. Unfortunately, there's a bit of an arms race when it comes to things like perks and salary, right? I mean, for whatever reason, there's actually the market for engineering talent is actually quite tight. And if you don't have, you know, expensive beanbag chairs and coffee and, you know, free food and all the various perks of startup life, it's going to be a hard time to convince a 23-year-old to take your job offer versus the six others that he or she has.
And Arkady, we thank you for your call. We're going to go right to another caller here, and a Berkeley caller joining us. Marcy, you're on. Morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I've worked in tech for most of my life, and I grew up in San Jose, actually. And I once had a recruiter tell me that for the startup companies he works for, it's almost exclusively the meteoric rise of mediocre people. And I just wanted to know kind of what your thoughts were on that.
That's a great phrase. I wish I would, if I could rewrite the book, I would steal that phrase and use it in the book. Yeah, it's true. And it sounds, you know, terribly sniffy and kind of arrogant to say so. But one of the things you find out, and I've gotten into trouble for saying this before, but so screw it, I'll say it again. You know, a lot of people who did very well for themselves at Facebook and Google, and I think they would admit this to themselves as well in a sober moment or maybe after the second beer, was that, you know, they kind of won the lottery, right? I mean, you know, they're great designers, right? Or they're great product managers. But if you look at the winner take all nature of Silicon Valley, you know, one person can work in a startup for 2 years and walk away worth $50 million, and the other will walk away worth nothing. And how that person can actually look at himself and say, yeah, I'm worth 50 million times more than this person. I deserve this, right? I think just kind of baffles me, right? As I mentioned in the book, meritocracy is the propaganda that anoints the charade, right? And so everyone sort of believes that it's this meritocracy that drives success, and I think they don't acknowledge the sort of more the chance aspects of their success. Because, of course, you can't. How can you accept that this guy – I mean, I remember I did the math at one point. Instagram was purchased for about $1 billion, and every person at Instagram cost about – I think it was $73 million per person, right? And then to get even more absurd, WhatsApp was bought for something like $19 billion, and the companies were comparable in size, right? And I think I used to joke that, you know, the $73 million Instagram engineer is looking at the $220 million WhatsApp engineer and saying, oh, that guy isn't worth it, right? I mean, it's just this chain all the way up. It's ridiculous. But yeah, so I agree. It is the meteoric rise of mediocre people occasionally. Yeah.
And thank you for that, Marcy. Good to hear from you. We're hearing from a number of listeners with responses to H-1B visa, which we spoke about, which Antonio writes about in his book. Richard writes, your guest is right about H-1B visa holders. What is worse is that most of these people could qualify for permanent residency now, but their employers want to control them by only giving them temporary status. And another listener, Amani, says H-1B visa is hardly an indentured servant program. Yes, one has to work, but the visa is transferable between companies. I work in human resources and take on this process all the time.
I mean, I'm not an HR lawyer, so I can't comment on that. But the case in question in 2010, when my non-U.S. national co-founder was moving from company, transferring H-1 visa was not in the picture. And certainly for a startup, I suspect the legal cost of doing that would be exceedingly high. I think it'd probably be best to get a commentary from someone who actually has an H-1 visa. I've never been in that situation. But I think the way they describe it, and I've had many people describe it to me, is like, look, I'm at Wells Fargo or Oracle or whatever company. I'm not even going to name them. And I'm just waiting for those 2 years to collapse so I can finally, you know, get out of there. I wouldn't be working at that company without it. And I've heard that more than once on Silicon Valley.
Here's a question to grapple with. Jesse asked, my fiance, a female, is moving from a small boutique tech firm to Google. How worried should I be?
I've never worked inside Google. I mean, the whole sexism thing, I know it comes up a lot. I feel I'm not really entitled to actually speak about it.
Well, that's the point, though. I mean, we talk about Silicon Valley with this big umbrella, but there are different cultures within Silicon Valley, within, to some degree, all of these big, giant companies.
I think so. Yeah, there's definitely a lot. Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
But then we got a good question from Ben. What are some ways that Silicon Valley can self-correct itself for its many shortcomings?
Well, which ones? Which ones are we talking about?
Yeah, there's a whole laundry list that we could go through here. But I think, you know, we're talking about the ethics of Silicon Valley, if you will, such as they are.
I think it's very difficult. I think the way that people often morally justify some of their Silicon Valley, what I call depredations, is to say, well, the technology is inevitable. Like it's obviously taxi drivers are going to go away because the mobile app is just better. And it doesn't matter that, you know, there's people who actually put food on the table for their families as taxi drivers. This is inevitable. Technology is just a steamroller. Get out of the way. And I'm not sure how to correct that. I mean, I think... this is a bigger question, but, you know, globalism, technology, the reality is lots of people in the future just won't have jobs. And I'm not sure that Silicon Valley has an answer to that yet.
We have some more callers joining us, perhaps with questions or comments. Alder, you're on. Good morning.
Hi there. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
So I work at the 3D printing shop in San Jose, and I'm noticing that a lot of our customers are like engineers who they've got really cool products, but they're where they work. It's not the startup scene that they were sold on. It's not the, you know, fast-moving, innovative kind of place. So I was wondering if maybe you could comment on if, you know, is Silicon Valley immune to the whole, like, as a company gets bigger, it just becomes more laurelly, more solid, you know, slower moving? Or have some companies kind of retained that culture? It seems like, you know, we're selling a lot of people on the dream of Silicon Valley where come here, work at these fast-paced companies, but maybe you get stuck at a desk-end job at Google. Desk-end job is the same as where you are.
All right, Elder, thank you for the question. Go to Antonio Martinez.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. In fact, I go into it in one chapter. I mean, Facebook was a company that was very aware of its own mortality, right? And it realized that as it got larger, it had to stave off sort of senescence in that way of no longer being that dynamic startup and took measures to do that. I think why Chaos Monkeys is interesting because it captured this unique time in Facebook's history in which it went from scrappy startup without a lot of rules to more big company, a little bit more sort of fossilized, more political. For example, in the first half of the book, as I mentioned, I brewed beer illegally on Facebook's campus and I blew up the plumbing and flooded Mark Zuckerberg's desk. Just let that sink in for a second. And there was no repercussions to it. In fact, like literally nothing happened. And by the end of that period, you know, there was political infighting, there was indecision, there was Facebook not being able to ship a product. You know, things were going in that big company direction. I mean, I think the reality is that like mortality, it's just inevitable. And it's up to the company to stave that off as long as possible. And I think Facebook has done that. But, yeah.
Well, you remind me of a story about Zuckerberg with paint.
Yeah,
you want to tell that story?
Yeah, so there's a lot of juicy anecdotes in there. So when Facebook moved from its somewhat dumpy former headquarters on Page Mill in California in Palo Alto, it moved to the former Sun campus, which is this large typical corporate campus type thing, and they basically gutted it, and then I guess Zuckerberg had the idea of look, we're going to just give everyone spray paint, and you're all going to just produce art. And you're going to sort of just decorate everything. There had been a long tradition of graffiti art at Facebook going back to the earliest days. And what happened was literally a scene out of Lord of the Flies if it happened inside a Home Depot, right? In the paint department of a Home Depot, right? People were painting everything everywhere and it was like a complete fiasco to the point that, two or three days later, I mean, Mark had to give this sort of unprecedentedly angry email to all saying, what have you done? You vandalized the place. And he basically went around with a piece of blue tape marking everything that looked disastrous and having it removed. And that was never attempted again.
Bring some more callers on. Bob, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thanks. I just wanted to point out that there's just a thin veneer of caring in the Valley now. And the real attitude is there are a lot of meritocratic winners, and everybody else is a loser. And let's either bust out the homeless or hope they die. That's really the attitude, and it's really a shame.
Well, thank you for that. Are we getting too stereotypical here about people in Silicon Valley, do you feel, or is that registering with you at all?
No, I think the caller was absolutely right.
Right on to you?
Yep, yeah. Absolutely.
Tom wants to know, what's been the social backlash to your book? How do people approach you?
That's a great question. I had assumed that I would be an utter pariah in Silicon Valley and that I was basically incinerating my tech career with this. And in fact, friends told me as much. The reaction thus far, obviously a biased sample because it's people willing to contact me, has actually been very much the opposite. Even some of the earlier Facebook employees, the people who are most vested in the company and the least sort of welcome to criticism, have actually reached out and said, I might disagree with a lot of the high level sort of, morality judgment around it. And maybe you got this or that other detail wrong, but basically you got it right. Like this is what it was like being inside Facebook at that time. And this is the best version that I've ever read of it. And kudos, we might disagree, I think, a little bit about Facebook, but kudos to you for having finally put it, documented it on paper.
And we go to more of your calls. Let me get to John on here. John from Mountain View, you're on. John, are you there? Okay. Let me, let me hold off here for a moment till, I'm sorry. Let me get John from San Jose on. John, go ahead.
Oh, there we go. Okay. Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
So, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, for a lot of the younger generations that are, coming in to try to fulfill this Silicon Valley dream, I guess, as it could be, a lot of us get to see these movies of Mark Zuckerberg and these movies of Steve Jobs. Is it really like that anymore? And how much longer is it? I mean, is this going to last?
It's a good question. It keeps morphing. So what do you think, Antonio?
I think it depends what you mean by what aspect of Jobs or Zuckerberg. I think, The Social Network was not a great movie. I think it was a work of fiction. It didn't remind me at all of what I worked at Facebook. I think what maybe the caller is referring to is the notion of the single visionary founder who drives an entire company in one direction. I think that very much is still in play. And Mark Zuckerberg is definitely very much in charge of Facebook. And I think that's actually a large cause of Facebook's success, actually. And that's, I think, what's wrong to some degree with Twitter as well. They don't necessarily actually have that strong founder at the helm.
But, you know, your portrait of Sandberg makes her seem pretty strong in terms of
absolutely.
Generals.
Yeah, no, I should include Cheryl in that description. I think, I think part of, Cheryl's own genius is she's such a great compliment, I think, to Zuckerberg. And together, they very capably run Facebook as a company.
Yeah. Here's Ron, who writes, and by the way, you can add your two cents here, so to speak. It doesn't go very far in terms of startups, but we do want to hear your thoughts. And talking about Silicon Valley and talking about Facebook and talking about H-1B visas, a whole range of things here. And certainly you can weigh in. Our toll-free number again is 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum. Ron writes on Facebook, and we asked a question on Facebook, particularly to tech workers, what do the rest of us, and you're hearing some of that here, this morning, get right or wrong about life in the world of tech. Ron writes, sure, Facebook execs are focused on making money, but I did not get why the vision of connecting the world lacks merit. I'm thumbs up on it.
No, I agree. No, I mean, at net, I think Facebook is probably positive for the world. But, if to put on my devil's advocate cap for a second, you look at the fact that something like, just to cite a particularly charged example, something like Islamic State has actually used social media to basically boost itself. It wouldn't exist without social media to a certain degree, right? Or, for example, there was an act of terrorism, a murder actually on Facebook that got live streamed, right? And we saw the murder of a family on Facebook. Of course, there's a positive side. For example, the unfortunate shootings that we had last week that were documented on Facebook Live. If it hadn't been for Facebook, there wouldn't have been a record of that actually. So every technology when it's first used is used both for good and for evil, right? To use those very morally polarized terms. And so, I agree with the caller. In the net of it, I think it'll probably be a good thing.
I saw something on Facebook just earlier this morning that I was really struck by and moved by. It was perhaps many of the listeners might have seen it too. There were protests in Dallas. There was protest of Black Lives Matter and there was an anti-protest. And what happened was, and I'm not even sure, just spontaneous, both sides came together and embraced, individuals embracing each other, trying to show a sense of community, really, and a sense of recognizing differences. And it was powerful. Noel wants to know, did the author work with anyone over 40? Any comments about age discrimination in tech?
No, I did not. Well, that's not true. Some of the senior management staff, I'm not sure their age, but they're probably north of 40. But people who are sort of in my peer group or my cohort, no, I was probably the oldest one. I'm probably older than most of my peers, in fact.
We have done shows on age discrimination in Silicon Valley, and I think it's really real. In fact, I think Frank, one of our callers, is going to talk right on point here. Frank, go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Yeah, I'm a contractor, and I got a call from one of the large tech firms that you've heard of, and he practically offered me a job on the phone. And then when I showed up, he saw that I was 60 years old, and you could tell on his face that this was not going to work. And he basically gave me a small job, and I never heard from him again.
It's real, the age discrimination. And I'm sorry you had to experience that, Frank, and thank you for bring it to our attention. Let me bring to attention a couple more listener emails. Stephen writes, many companies such as Facebook and Google have created separate tiers of stock without voting power so that companies can raise money and the founders can retain all the control. This seems like a rotten deal for investors. Any comments from your guest?
It's true. There was a Facebook shareholder meeting recently in which evidently I don't know all the procedural details, but Zuckerberg somehow managed to finagle for himself weightier founder shares. Look, I mean, the company's done very well, right? Its stock has quadrupled in price since I left. It's hard to question leadership that produces those returns.
Well, here's a listener who may be weighing in on a different side. Matt is calling us from Sonoma, and Matt raising a question about the future of Facebook. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just curious. You know, I mean, it seems as though that Facebook has been around forever, I imagine, but less than 10 years, I think, isn't it correct? And I was just curious. It seems to me there's got to be a shelf life to it. I mean, maybe it'll be just like an AT&T or an old state company eventually, but what will be – something's going to come up on its heels. What do you think?
So I think that's true. I mean, the meme about Facebook as the next MySpace, I think, is not true. I mean, Facebook usage is still going strong, but you're right. It could always fail. But I think social media, our social world in your pocket is not going to go away. Here's one of the things that I learned writing this book. I wrote this book on a small island. I realized that Facebook reproduced the dynamics of a small town, but in electronic form, right? literally on a small town, everyone knows who everyone is. There's no privacy. You check into a bar by showing up and everyone knows you're there. Facebook just reproduces that for our sort of socially fractured age where we don't work where we were raised. We don't have family around us. We don't know who's in the building. And so what Facebook is that sort of magical Dunbar's number. That's the 150 people that we know and care about and whose lives we want to learn about. The only difference now is that it's in our pocket, right? And that's not going to change. Humans are not going to stop socializing. They're not going to stop caring about 150 people. The only question is how they actually conduct that care and that love and that connection. And Facebook happens to be the way that it's done now. But you're right. 50 years from now, it may not be Facebook, but social media is not going to go away.
We're talking to Antonio Garcia Martinez, author of Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. And I wonder how you respond to this listener. It says, those who can make it in the tech business do. Those who can't, write an expose book about it.
I don't think that's quite true. I'll think about that a year from now when I'm sailing on my yacht in the Pacific. How about that?
All right. Well, in the meantime, we'll sail over to some more callers. We'll go to Menlo Park. Felicia, morning.
Good morning. Well, I have a rather mundane question. I'm wondering how the thing of living in San Francisco and working down in Menlo Park started. And I love the city, but, I mean, why don't they live in beautiful Menlo Park or Palo Alto? I mean, some of them do, but how did that get started and it's causing so much trouble up in the city with the buses?
It's a good question. I cite the image in the book that there's one corner in San Francisco, 24th and Valencia, where all the buses converge. And you go there in the morning and you see sort of a ramshackle muni bus and you see these beautiful corporate buses and everyone's going to their different destinations, right? I think the reason why it exists is that same bus stop. It's the Mission District, which is most of your listeners probably know is like the new trendy part of San Francisco. And the relatively young employees at Facebook want to live in a cool, hip place. They don't want to live in suburbia is the reality. And so they're willing to put up. I used to make the commute. I lived in the Mission for a while. And they put up with that 45-minute commute. I don't think they love it. But compared to living in, blah suburbia, they make that trade.
I think that is a big reason behind it, that and the fact that San Francisco has a lot to offer. I mean,
right.
You know, it's a magnet of a city because there's so much in it. Let me thank you, Felicia, for that call, and we'll go right to Mountain View. Ray, you're on.
Howdy. I started in a small company in early 70s. It was in Sunnyvale. And the thing that really struck me about the company was the president of the company really finagled things so that he retained control of the company, 51%, and he did that for years and years, even though he had very smart guys working for him, you know, guys from Caltech, University of Arizona, really very capable guys. And I think it was out of fear, right? And I think a lot of these founders, you know, they see very smart guys, but they do it out of fear that they will lose control or they'll be kicked out. And it's really too bad because I think they miss a lot of good help with that.
Yeah, well, thank you for those comments. It's good to hear from you. And let's talk about startups for a moment because you certainly make it your readers aware of just how hard it is and how demanding it is and how crazy it is. I mean, just the hours that people put into startups, they really literally don't have lives.
That's right. I mean, every waking hour was dedicated to my startup. As you hinted at earlier, I missed my child's first birthday because we were launching. I would sleep in the office. I saw my child grow up basically through the window of a Skype session because they were living in Alameda and I was in Mountain View. It is an absolutely absolutely all-engrossing pursuit.
Here's a comment from a listener who tweets, change alone is not morally corrupt. Ask the inventor of the cotton gin. Change is inevitable. Jobs will morph, not go away. Optimistic view. Nice to read. Here's a question from a listener. How would the author characterize the Hispanic tech communities in Silicon Valley? I understand San Jose community is substantial. You see a good presence in Silicon Valley of Hispanics?
No, not at all. I was probably the only Hispanic person that I knew at Facebook, actually, or one of the very few.
And that applies to generally people of color, except a good number of Asian Americans, perhaps, or not?
Oh, I mean, this whole ethnic thing is interesting because, diversity means different things to different people. I'll share a personal anecdote. There was a photo shared on Facebook of the early ads team. It was about half the ads team, and I was in the photo. And I was remarking that everyone in that photo had been born. I was the only one in that photo who had actually been born in the United States, and I was probably the only person in that photo who actually spoke English as a first language. And so I know that people often criticize tech for being not being diverse, but it, you know, I can count, I think, with the fingers on one hand, the number of sort of WASPs or sort of traditional whites that I work with. It was an extraordinarily diverse crowd.
It was an ethnic mix.
It was a Benetton ad, basically. I mean, with certain biases, one part of the world or the other. But and the numbers prove it out. I forget the census numbers are something like 1/3 of the U.S. tech force is actually foreign born.
Quick question. What advice does Antonio have for those of us looking for entry-level positions in Silicon Valley tech in order to join the middle class, but who are aware and wary of the destructive culture he describes?
I would maybe get a job in a later stage company where a lot of these cultish aspects I describe are maybe not quite as prevalent.
Do you want to name any companies?
No, I'm not going to take sides on that one.
Okay. Well, that's reasonable advice. And again, it's good to have you on here. The book took guts to read. It took guts to write. I wanted to at least give you a prop for that. And we thank you for being with us, spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
And you, our listeners, by the way, can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org/forum. We certainly encourage you to do that. And tomorrow during this hour, John Leguizamo will be our guest. He's got a one-man show at the Berkeley Repertory Theater. And I went and saw it over the weekend and found it really quite entertaining and very funny. It's called Latin History for Morons. We've been talking with Antonio Garcia Martinez. His book, again, Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. And we thank you for joining us. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Annie Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Sheffer-Wolf. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Joanne Wallace. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.